And welcome to Drawing Blood. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And today we're talking about dental phantoms, which are these incredible objects that Christy has introduced me to, and I'm sure you as well. I'd never heard of them before this episode. And via that, we're going to talk about all things teeth and mouths and Freud and facial difference and race and class and all the usual areas we end up in. Most of all, why the dentist and going to the dentist is so scary and what that can tell us about, how we think about the face and subjectivity and a whole host of other things.
Yeah, absolutely. We get into a lot of different areas with this episode, but as always, content warning, we talk a lot about body horror and describe some disturbing scenes, particularly from movies, particularly if mouth stuff, teeth stuff freaks you out, this might not be the episode for you. So just a little bit of a warning about that. We also, as we often do in our episodes, end up addressing, you know, difficult histories around race, around class. So just a heads up for that as well.
Yeah, I think I'm hoping we haven't lost all of our listenership by saying if mouth stuff freaks you out, don't listen to this one, because I feel like one of our points is that mouth stuff freaks everyone out.
So yes, we're very excited to talk about teeth. And teeth are weird is what I've been thinking about. Do you agree?
Yeah. Teeth are the visible bones of your face.
Bones of your face out in public, right? Simultaneously so personal and everyone can see them pretty much all the time, especially if you're American, because you're just like mouth open talking all the time.
Yeah, it's funny. This is one of those episodes where I feel like you told me you wanted to do this and I was like, Christy, I have nothing to say. I have nothing to say about teeth. All I have to say about teeth is that I remember reading in, it must have been some like teen magazine when I was younger, that if you have dreams about your teeth falling out, it means that you think you're ugly. And I was like, well, guess I think I'm ugly.
Well, not that teen magazines are like, you know, interpretation of dreams par excellence, but I always thought that losing your teeth meant that you thought that you were losing control.
Look, please don't bring up Freud, because he is one of the few things I do have to contribute to this conversation. But I think in general, like, yeah, well, look, obviously the first thing is that any, like, what's the word, extrinsic analysis of an individual's dreams, I think is not correct. Like, there is no universal interpretation. Yep. But I guess it is wild to me that it is such a common nightmare. I mean, it's like dreams of falling, dreams of your teeth falling out, but teeth falling out is so hyper specific. And I have lots of thoughts about why, because initially I was like, I have nothing to say. And then I was thinking about it and I was like, okay, I mean, the teeth themselves, teeth as part of the mouth, absolutely. Like, there is so much. Our mouth does everything. It's like all of our functions we need to live happen through our mouths. Like, we breathe, we eat, we ingest things, we also expel things, you know, vomit, blood, and it's an erotic sight, you know. Think about like the mouth, like half parted, how much we read in the mouth. And I, one of the fantastic essays I read in prep for this episode is called Open Wide by Stephen Joy, and it's an essay actually on Thomas Mann and his fiction and his fixation with the mouth. But one of the things he said, Stephen Joy said, is we look at the mouth because we can't look at the genitals. Like, it is a secondary, do you know what I mean? Like, it's a secondary sex characteristic. Is that the word I'm looking for?
No, definitely. And like, think about oral fixation, or even something even more like a breeding characteristic, even more innocent than that, like the smile across the bar or something, you know, like the emotional valences of the mouth are so important for relationships, for communicating who you are, for leading to those sexual relationships, all of that. I mean, there's just so many things. And we're not going to be talking about teeth disembodied. It's all about teeth in context today.
So it's no surprise to me that dreams about your teeth, that a fixation of the teeth is such a big part of our culture. And as I understand it in my, you know, relatively novice to this topic positionality, it's something that we've been obsessed with for years. Like I remember when I was a child in one of those Egyptology books or something, reading that like the mummies had like dental work done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm so glad that even though you were skeptical at the beginning, you have become a importance of teeth convert.
I've become a tooth head.
A tooth head. Yeah. Yeah. So sorry, that was unexpected. I'm glad that I've converted you, and hopefully everybody listening who maybe saw our title and is like, I don't know if I want to listen to that. Hopefully you'll be converted by the end of this too, as to why teeth in the mouth are just so endlessly fascinating. Okay. So let's start with the object. As listeners of our podcast will know, you know, this is our beginning of our third season. So just a little recap, one of us will always bring in an object of focus, and then we just unspool that in whatever directions our bonkers minds take it to. So let's get to the object that I wanted to bring today. Emma, could you open up that link and tell me what you're seeing and describe it for our audience?
Okay, so I'm looking at the image and I have a confession to make, which is that I cheated and I looked at this first, because when you told me we were doing an episode on dental phantoms, I was like, I couldn't even begin to tell you what that is.
I mean, which is fair. I would think that most people don't have a frame of reference for what a dental phantom is.
I know, but then most people don't have to go on a podcast and sound smart about it for an hour. Okay. So, and this is not the exact one I saw when I Googled it, but it's very similar. And I'm super excited because I think in this case, getting to look at it gave me time to reflect on what I had to say about it. So this I'm looking at, it's such a bizarre object. I mean, I actually think like of all the objects that we've talked about on this podcast, this is one of the weirder ones. But what we're looking at is, it's a face. It's in three dimensions, like a sculpture. Or I say it's a face. It's sort of in the shape of a face. Basically, we have the top half is metal, looks like aluminium, like a very shiny brushed silver. It's this like hard polish. It almost looks like I'm thinking of medieval helmets and war. This silver is basically from the nose up, and then there's like a little flap over the cheeks, but there's no slit for the eyes. And in fact, there's barely even, there's sort of a brow, like the metal juts out at the eyebrow point, but then beneath that it is flat. And then the nose juts out, but sort of like armor, like in a very stylized sort of triangular shape. And beneath that, you have this sort of set of dentures, like the sort that you see in a dentist's office when you're getting taught how to brush and floss, you know, with these really pink gums and these very white teeth. There are some fillings in the teeth. But because there are no lips, it's kind of scary. And honestly, the first thing it brings to mind for me, besides helmet and almost this, I mean, because of the metal and the helmet and the proximity to the flesh, there's almost like cyborg, like, you know, mishmash of flesh and metal, is a chimpanzee. You know how they, I don't know if you know about chimpanzee fear grins, but it's sort of this case
They draw their lips back, right?
Exactly. Humans think that they're smiling. When chimps are doing what looks to us like smiling, it's actually a fear grimace. And because there is nothing else to quote unquote read in this, in this object, all you have is this kind of horrifying, actually quite scary bearing of the teeth and the gums.
I did not expect you to take it to chimps, I'm going to be honest. But it's a bearing of teeth that also reads as a scream, because in these particular images, like the mouth is open. Like it's not just a closed set of dentures showing the teeth. The mouth is open. But I also, if you look really closely, or if you, there are multiple images on the website that we'll link in the show notes. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom, you can also see that there are things that look like either fillings or cavities within the back molars. So this isn't a perfect set of teeth. It's imperfect, right? And I love that you said that it reminded you of the kinds of dentures that a dentist would use to teach you how to brush your teeth or floss your teeth, because as scary as this is, and as like surreal, uncanny, just bizarre as this object is, this is a teaching object. This is a medical education tool.
I didn't realize you could swipe through the images. And as I do, I'm also just struck by, firstly, even more by the cyborg thing. Like, you can see the rivets where the cheeks or the cheeks stand in. I don't know how to talk about this object. It's really interesting. Are attached to the head, ? And this metal rod that goes up in the place of your vertebra or your skull. You know, it looks like a tool, a scientific tool. But there's also something really interesting happening that I hope we'll get into about inside and outside, or like surface and depth, both in the sense of things being exposed from the inside, things being exposed that we wouldn't expect, like the gums, but also this shiny, deflective, metal, impenetrable outside that is kind of somewhere between a mask, which is something you wear over a face, and the skull, which is what is under your face. And I think that because the mouth is all about inside and outside, that's really interesting.
Yes, and that's what I was saying about teeth at the very beginning. Like, they are simultaneously so private on the inside and so public, like how you signal to other humans that you don't mean harm, that you are X, Y, and Z. Like, they are so public as well. So, really good, really interesting thoughts there. And I cannot wait to get into all of them. Okay. So let me tell you where I found these.
I'm dying to know where you found these, how these came up for you. Also, what they have to do with phantoms. I mean, I have thoughts, but it's very clearly not phantom as in ghost, but maybe we'll get into it.
Yes. Okay. So I found these. You can see from the link that I sent you, this is not like a medical museum link. The link that I've sent you is a home furnishings company. And so I found these objects from this random article on Atlas Obscura that I'll also link. And it was all about how this contemporary artist named Mariano Chavez had actually, in his gallery in Chicago, had started selling these as art objects. And then that led me into this whole rabbit hole on Etsy, on eBay, on home furnishing sites, where these dental phantoms, these quote unquote like vintage sculptural objects, you know, they're being framed as being sold for people's homes. Like the Agent Gallery in Chicago, I think this is a mistake, but if you're on the Dental Phantoms page, the URL is Agent Gallery Chicago, like the end of the URL is /furniture. So it's in the furniture category.
Can I just say, this is more horrifying to me than collecting dolls.
If you went to someone's house and saw, I'll link to a picture in the show notes where from Agent Gallery Chicago, where it is just a group of them and they all have their mouths open and they look like they're like singing together in a choir or screaming together. That's more what it looks like. And like, can you imagine walking into someone's home? Like, can you imagine being on a first date and, you know, deciding like, yeah, sure, I'll go up for a drink with this person. And you open it up and it's just dental phantoms as furniture. Yeah, no.
Get out.
So that's what got me really interested. So I'm like, okay, they're clearly, I think that these are really visually interesting. And clearly a lot of other people also think that they're really visually interesting. Granted, they might be using them or buying them for a very different purpose or thinking about them for a very different purpose than I would be, but I want to figure out what's going on. In addition to there being the people who are selling these objects as is, basically, like saying, oh, we're really interested in these sculptural aspects of these, like the way that they allude to other works or paintings in art history. But then you've got also like edgelord contemporary artists, you know, repurposing them to play up that steampunk aesthetic. There's this guy named Brian Gabasco who is adding glass eyes and, you know, making them even scarier as further sculptural objects. So that's just the kind of current online landscape of dental phantoms that I was looking at. I was like, why are they existing this way?
Although I have to say, as a Victorianist, nothing impresses me or scares me less than fucking steampunk. Can I just say?
I totally, totally get it. But you know, there's
steampunk is not art. And I will, you can quote me on that.
I'm with you. I feel like it's a very Gen X thing.
100%. It's like a first wave of hipsters coded. Regarding the collecting these as art objects, I mean, besides the teeth, which are the element of kitsch or like camp and sort of horror in these in this object that you've shown me, there is a sort of almost Brancusi, you know, burnished metal 30s or 20s or even 10s, like sculptural abstract thing going on. I see that. I do see that.
Yes, absolutely. And the one that I showed you is from the mid 20th century from a New York based company who made a ton of these. But yeah, so that's kind of the landscape of where they're existing now. So dental phantoms started to appear in like the 1870s through the 1890s. There was kind of a flurry of patent applications or presentations about dental phantoms in that like 20-year period. That being said, the use of phantoms, and we'll get around to defining phantoms, the use of phantoms was happening in medicine before that, but it popped up in dentistry in the late 19th century. And so in my obsessive cataloging of all the different phantoms that I could find, there are like five main categories, right? You've got the good old teeth on a stick, which is not what I showed you, but literally it's teeth on a stick. You've got the plain head. So like the metal one that I showed you, sometimes that'll be in wood. You've got one that looks like a skull. So it's harping cadaver dentistry or like cadaver dentist practice without being the actual skull. You've got the wig maker model, which is like using the wooden head that a wig maker would use to put the wig on to like make the wig. You've just got this blank wooden sphere basically that teeth are inserted into. And then you've got a realistic face. Yeah. So they're like taking from the cosmetic side of things, like, okay, wig makers use that, taking from the medical education side of things, like, oh, skulls, we know how to do medical education on cadavers. So like taking from all these different visual cues to make these different types of phantoms. Yeah, so, and we'll link to all of these different types in the show notes. But basically, this guy named Oswald Fergus in 1894 is probably the most well-known creator of the dental phantom. And he did the teeth on the stick, and I've got a link for you of his diagram. And so you'll see it's literally just gums, not even the jaw, and stick. And I think it's hilarious that in his speech about this phantom, he was like, yes, this is really important because it's about, this will give the students the correct surroundings for practicing dentistry. And yet it's literally teeth on a stick, completely devoid of anything else.
It looks like those like cheap children's toys or castanets or something, you know, where you like clap the two things together.
Yeah. You can almost imagine this, like, you know that like cartoon comedy trope of the chattering dentures like running away.
Exactly.
It's that. But he was like, look, what they were using before was teeth that were in clamps. And he was like, that doesn't mimic the gums, right? It's just individual teeth clamped in. And he's like, cadavers suck because you can't put the teeth back in. And he was very right on this. He was like, also, our dental students tend to start practicing on live patients a little bit too soon. So maybe we should have something that allows them to not do that.
That's a horrifying thought. Yeah. Yeah.
He also said that to make those surroundings more realistic, they would add elastic bands to the side of these disembodied teeth to make it feel like cheeks, which once again, how realistic can that have felt?
And it's like braces. Like people who wear the elastics on their braces.
Oh, that's how I found out I was allergic to latex. That was a fun moment in middle school. Yeah, that was really traumatic, actually.
As a sidebar, I mean, I think the number of like dental horror stories that people have. Are you scared of the dentist?
Oh, well, no, I should be because I did. I'm more scared of anesthesiologists because I woke up during my wisdom tooth surgery. And, you know, after a couple seconds, they realized that I was awake and they amped up the anesthesia. But so I should be afraid. I'm more afraid of going under then because that happened than dentistry. Just a little bit of my own trauma sprinkled into this episode. Why not?
I think a lot of people are very scared of the dentist.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you can imagine I'd probably be more afraid of the dentist in the late 19th century if these trainee dentists were just like operating on people before they're ready. But anyway, there were other people like much earlier in the 1870s who were making dental phantoms. Like the next image is the one that looks like a skull. And this one was by Edward Fleischer from Germany. And, you know, this phantom came with a complete set of perfect teeth, as well as a complete set of teeth in which each one of them had a cavity in it. And then it also came with a a fake salivary gland. So like you could have like the dry practice and then the wet practice.
It's giving smell-o-vision. Like it's, do you know what I mean? Like all these inventions about like what people thought the future would look like. Also, I feel like there's going to be a lot of sidebars to this because I just have things to say about teeth that have nothing to do with dental patterns. Have you ever watched on TikTok, there's a very young girl who does like ASMR where she has this set of teeth and she like has these little like cavity stickers that she sticks on it. And then she like uses these like tongs to like pry them off.
No, but medical ASMR is such a thing.
Yeah. Anyway, it's bizarre. Amazing. Anyway. Well, especially because I think that the drill, the high-pitched drill is like one of those like horror sounds that we associate.
We will definitely talk about the drill sound.
Fantastic.
But anyway, I'll wrap up now. But so people in the 70s through 90s in the 19th century were coming up with like wig makers, wooden head, the fully realistic face, the skull version, etc.
Yeah, just like looking at these, the images that you sent through, it is interesting how much they lean into some of the things that even the very first image made me think of. Like no matter how different each of these objects are, they are playing with very similar ideas. I mean, the one you sent through that is two skulls, it's so Vanitas, Memento Mori, which I didn't mention it, but was another thing that the head you showed me made me think of, is it's such a common trope in Vanitas or Memento Mori paintings to have like half the skull with the teeth still in it, like almost clamping down on something.
Yes.
And then the wooden one is completely horrifying and I can't quite put my finger
on that. Right. That's the wig maker's block. And I think it's because there's no gesture towards a face. It is completely featureless. There's no nose. There's no eyes. It is just a block of wood
with human teeth, which feels like fetishistic. Like it feels like a talisman almost. And like an object with like magical power, that some combination of those materials, metal, wood, and teeth and no features. Yeah,
absolutely. You're totally right. And then just as a final image, I wanted to show you a dental phantom in use. So I found this Getty Images picture from the 20th century of when dental hygienists started to be trained, like when that became a profession. And you've got these two smiling young women, young white women, training on a dental phantom.
Oh my God. Okay. This makes me think of the other thing I thought of when I saw the dental phantom, the first dental phantom, which is the film Alien. And I have thoughts on that as well. What's that? It's called a xenomorph.
Yes. Oh, I can totally picture it. And I'm sure, I feel like that's one of the most, like even people who haven't seen Alien, which I haven't, know exactly. I know. I'm sorry. I know.
I'm horrified.
Like know exactly what the alien looks like.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting to me because like, everyone knows that Alien is a film about like vagina dentata and, you know, the horror of the female castrator. You know, it's something that it's this horrifying form that is birthed from a woman and that already has teeth and that can kill and bite and is phallic in shape and yet has no eyes, which I think is super interesting and maybe something we'll talk about.
Like most the dental phantoms, although some of them do have eyes, which is perhaps more unsettling. No, I think actually that's unsettling. Sorry.
Anyway, it's just like, just that it's like a horror trope. The biting faceless creature with no eyes.
Or, and I mean, that continues to things like Stranger Things, like even though that's a slightly different format, but it's this all mouth, like what is that thing called? The Demogorgon. The Demogorgon is all mouth, right? Like it has no eyes. It just senses and then can destroy you with its mouth and its teeth.
And I think there is something in what we find horrifying about dental phantoms that does have to do with animality.
Yes. Right. So you can see in this image dental hygienists practicing on a dental phantom. But quite the longer history of phantoms is quite gendered as well. And the use of phantoms is most prominent in obstetrics. So one of the most well-known obstetric phantoms, which I know you've already mentioned cyborgs, and so I want to talk about the human machine, but obstetric phantoms were also called obstetric machines. So there's this slippage between phantom and machine that is constantly happening. And then that added slippage between phantom and the human body, because like they're supposed to be equivalent. Anyway, we'll get to that.
That's so interesting.
There's this really famous one that I will link to in the show notes. And Emma, do you want to open up the link that I sent you of this obstetric phantom and just describe it before folks go and look at the image?
I think you've sent this to me before, or we've discussed it, or, I mean, we've been friends for a long time. I've seen this before, and I'm sure it's because of you, but it's this cloth, I want to say. It's, oh my, how do I even describe this? It's the bottom half of a woman. Her vagina is basically sort of just a gaping hole. There's some effort to depict the vulva, but it's very stylized. Her legs are sort of stumps and they're being held up in stirrups. And then in front of her is this horrifying baby connected to her with an umbilical cord. That baby also, for some reason, I'm really interested in what aspects of the anatomy they think are important to depict. That baby also has a visible vulva and like really prominent toes. Although
its
face,
also massive.
Yes, it's massive. Although its face looks like it's wearing a mask of some sort, or has under.
It's like it just had a nose job.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's exactly what I was going to say. And can I just say that once again, this is, you know, interesting slippage between art and sexuality and medical practice. And the bottom in the French, it says, La machine de Madame de Coudray exposée au Musée Flaubert. And exposée is a really interesting word here, because of course in French it means exhibited, but it's also, it means exposed. And there is something very interesting to me about that slippage here, because it is so, despite the fact that this is a mannequin, it's a vulnerable and kind of graphic object.
Oh, and it is so interesting that you just said mannequin, and we will get back to that. But right, so this is an object that was created for practicing childbirth, or practicing difficult childbirth in particular. You can set up the fetus in different ways so that, you know, if it's a breech birth, you can know how to position your arms, et cetera. And this was created by a woman. But one of the reasons that this type of obstetric phantom was made was kind of to assuage the moral concerns of men touching women's bodies, like before they were full-fledged man midwives, right? So this phantom is standing in literally for the woman's body. And yet we can see immediately how, like Oswald Fergus saying, oh, this dental phantom allows you to see the surroundings. We can see immediately how this would be inadequate for that type of teaching, right? No legs, nothing above like the breastbone, you know, massive baby that would just, nothing would sit in a way that would be close to reality, right?
Well, and this brings up a lot of art history stuff. I mean, for one thing, there's a very, the immediate thing I thought of when you said that was, that's the same reason that there were limitations on studying from the live nude model for artists in the 19th century, that women couldn't study from, for the most part, depending on where you were, from male nudes, and in their place, you would study models, you'd study plaster casts of nude, of individuals.
Yes. And it's just that these are called machines or phantoms rather than models or casts, right? Did I say that this is 18th century obstetrics? Did I say that? So as I, you know, this is earlier than the dental phantoms, right? So obstetric phantoms were happening in the 18th century, largely during that movement for the man midwife, right? The quote unquote professionalization of midwifery and moving it away from women. Now, I want to focus a little bit on like that machine idea, because I know you're really interested in that, Emma. But there's this brilliant article by Margaret Carlyle writing about these obstetric phantoms. And she's saying that these phantoms really help to contribute to the 18th or the new views in the 18th century of the body as mechanistic, right? So think about like Foucault and the medical gaze. Think about like, you know, the machine-like or efficient nature of man, and like how she's saying that these phantoms, these obstetric machines, help to make that concrete, like in the medical realm, which I think is really interesting.
Can you explain how a little bit? Because I know, you know, as a 19th century person who also does history of science, I mean, in a general sense, I'm, you know, familiar with this idea of the mechanistic idea of the world. On the one hand, I guess from Newtonian physics and a new understanding of how the world fits together, but then also with the quote unquote rationalization of time and, you know, the use of that time on, for instance, the factory floor. So we have like industrialization, labor, and the human body being regulated in the new way. But what does this have to do? Spell it out a little bit for me. What does this have to do with the phantoms?
Yeah. So I'm like the way that there are steps to complete things, like to complete medical procedures, or there are steps in order to have a successful birth. Like that is a mechanized process, right? Like even if it's breech or even if it's a problem birth in another way, like you can use tools, you can use forceps, and you can learn these mechanized ways of birth, these scientized ways of birth that aren't just, you know, the neighborhood woman, the neighborhood midwife coming and doing something that semen is feminine. It's like the mechanized male-led steps to a successful birth. And I think we can especially see this. I'm going to just show one more of these obstetric phantoms. We can especially see this in the way that pocket phantoms existed. So like small phantoms that midwives or obstetricians could bring around to work out the correct positioning, the correct like steps in order to get the baby out, right? So I've sent you one by Shibuta, the pocket phantom, and it's a little paper doll and a paper pelvis that you would, the paper doll is in the back of the book, on the back cover of the book, nestled into a pelvis. So you can kind of work out the mechanical positioning of this doll. I say doll because I've read some brilliant work by Rebecca Whiteley, who writes about these as paper dolls. But these phantoms, I should say.
Yeah. I don't think it's a coincidence that this comes from obstetrics. You know, that the mouth is such a sexualized... I mean, for Freud, it was literally perverse because it's an erotic object that perverts the normal reproductive, procreative, like normal in huge scare quotes, you know, forms of sex that people are supposed to be having.
And to throw another like big hitter, not that Bakhtin and Freud are, you know, the same, but... like Bakhtin also writes about how the mouth is the center of all of the grotesque. Like you're talking about the sexual and the perverse. It's also the bodily grotesque. Bakhtin writes like the mouth dominates all else. The grotesque face is actually reduced to the gaping mouth. The other features are only a frame encasing this wide open bodily abyss. Bodily abyss, that's like so that gaping vagina.
Yes.
In the French obstetric phantom.
Yes. And look, Freud, grain of salt, but, you know, the mouth, I think it's important. I mean, you know, Freud talks about the mouth and I think we mentioned oral fixation already.
Briefly. Yeah.
But, you know, it's this idea, I think if I remember correctly, you know, it comes from this idea that the baby is fixated on like suckling on the mother's nipple and then a sort of perversion of the quote unquote normal sexual growth and functioning of the male, I think especially male child, is to grow up and still want to like suck on a thumb or like suck on another sort of phallic stand-in for the mother. If I remember correctly, the place where Freud is talking about the oral fixation, he's talking about one of his patients, Irma. She doesn't want this oral examination of her mouth, and she eventually sort of yields to it. And in doing so, this is the argument by Stephen Joy in that article I already mentioned, you know, she exposes Freud to this image of castration because the mouth for Freud is the place where, on the one hand, it's this gaping hole, which is like vaginal or lack in his, I'm doing huge scare quotes, which listeners cannot see.
Yep.
But it is replete with teeth, which are mini phallic objects. So it's both like the Medusa, the ultimate image of female, of castration anxiety, you know, this sense of female retributive power who has all these snakes, these phallic objects swarming around her head. It's this excess of the phallic at the same place that there's an absence.
There's so much to say about these obstetric phantoms. Like this could be a whole other episode as well. I mean, from our dollhouse, our season 2, episode 2, Dollhouses of Death episode, like you can talk about these as dolls, you can talk about them as like being medical play, but like also sexual play, as you were talking about. And as you say, really interesting that this history of phantoms is coming largely from obstetrics. It also, it had existed in some form or another in ophthalmology and laryngology. So the larynx, the voice box.
Yeah.
But again, these are all orifices, right? Like these are all things that are like both inside and outside of the body, eyes, vagina, mouth, right? And phantoms are useful for getting away in and taking something out.
And what is the mouth if not our biggest hole?
Oh my God. Okay.
Like it's honestly, I'm being flippant, but like It is the part of our body where the inside is on the outside, not only in terms of, as I jokingly said earlier, the bones of the face, but you know, it's also the only place where we see into seeing that, like, you know, the soft palates and like the tongue. It is the fleshy, raw, red, bloody inside of the face of the body that we all see every day.
Yeah, I think this is so on the money for this, especially as it relates to the history of obstetric phantoms. So are you ready to go to why the hell are they called phantoms? Do you want to try to figure that out with me? So the terminology around these obstetric objects was really fraught. There was like this glowing report of the Madame de Coudray obstetric phantom written by two physicians. And they, in like the actual archival evidence of the report, Margaret Carlyle writes about this, they wrote phantom and then crossed it out and then wrote mannequin and then crossed it. Like they couldn't figure out what to name them, right? And it's still not totally clear why phantom has won out. Although from the research that I've done for this episode, like it really seems that phantom is the European term and mannequin ends up being what's used in America. And so I haven't quite parsed that out, but that seems to be the thing. So yeah, what are your thoughts around the word phantom?
Well, if I look at, I'm like, the Oxford English Dictionary defines phantom as, but actually it's, you know, if you look at the etymology of the word, right? So it comes from the French fantôme or like phantom. And as early as like the 12th century, we have it meaning illusion or delusion. Then also in the 12th century, we have it as supernatural apparition or ghost, which I think is probably what most of us first think of when we think of phantom.
Immediately ghost. Yes. Immediately ghost.
17th century, ineffectual person or thing, which I kind of love and is really interesting.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
From what I just said, I was just like, we can tell that this obstetric phantom wouldn't be like reality. It'd be pretty ineffectual for, you know, really helpful medical training.
Like the sculpture instead of a live nude model for artists. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then it says rare model of body / organ for surgical instruction. And I think it relates it to mannequin. So
yes, right. And mannequin comes from little man in the Dutch, which is really interesting in itself from like the gendered perspective of what obstetric phantoms and obstetric mannequins usually ended up being. But also I just love from that one definition that you just said that phantom could be an insult. Like you're such a phantom, like totally ineffectual person. Like,
I love it.
I love it. But yeah, there really hasn't been much written about why these are called phantoms, but I think it has a lot to do with the uncanny, with there being no physical reality, with it being ineffectual, with it being an illusion. Even if it's an ineffectual illusion, like that is what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we're talking mostly dental phantoms, but also be thinking of those obstetric phantoms that we just talked about.
For sure. And I think as an occultism person, I get very like, ugh, about like using ghost or phantom as a Fair. Metaphor because it never Fair. Is. Like it's always a very culturally Right. specific thing. But I do Sure. think you're right that in the sense of a word carries meanings with it. And even if it is quote unquote only being used to refer to a model of the body or organ, you know, I'm thinking of like phantom limbs. Like we do have the sense of this crossover, even in how we talk, in how we commonly use the word phantom for meaning something that isn't there, but it's sort of a stand-in for something is there. And it doesn't have to be haunted, even if because of horror tropes, we do think it's haunted.
Right. It's not the only time. Like phantom is used much wider in medical parlance as well, yeah. in ways that we recognize it more. You've got phantom limbs. You've got phantom pain. You've even got a thing called phantom face, which I read this piece by a neurologist who wrote about that feeling when you're being numbed at the dentist, actually, that your face is being rearranged or that it's in some grotesque.
So interesting.
A rearrangement. And that was from a 1992 really short article. So like this phantom idea, you know, pops up quite a lot throughout medicine. This idea that there's something there that is not reality. And yet it is yes. still something that is medically diagnosable. It's pathological, etc.
Well, it's the double. And even if we don't go to the place of ghosts, the double is the uncanny. I mean, for Freud, the uncanny, you know, unheimlich is that which is familiar yet strange. And dolls and mannequins are, of course, the example. Of course, when Freud is talking about this, in the story he's pointing to, he points out that it's not just the doll that's the uncanny or the double that's the uncanny, but he talks about blindness, which I think is really interesting in terms of, you know, these objects which don't have their eyes. But I think that idea of the double, the stand-in for the human that is like us but not like us, is another reason these objects are so scary. You know, they suggest something that is so human, our teeth, and suggest the outlines of a face while giving us absolutely nothing, you know?
Right.
And I really want to talk, you mentioned rearranging the face, which all I could think about for some reason, and I want to unpack why, when I looked at these objects, was Deleuze and faciality and facelessness and the idea of escaping the face, because that is the thing that remains the most interesting to me about these objects. Like, firstly, what makes a face? What unmakes a face? What are the items that we need to be in place for it to be a face? And I think that gets into why it's scary. But also, it's more like a pop culture link, but do you know Kevin James Thornton?
No.
Okay. He does these reels and I think TikToks where he like records himself telling stories in auto-tune. Yes.
The super fundamentalist Christian church guy.
I think so. Yeah. Now I'm doubting myself, but
he's like, in my super fundamentalist Christian church.
Yes. Okay. Can I play you one quickly?
Yes, please.
Okay.
This video, he's in like his typical, you know, patterned shirt and doing an auto-tune story. He has some wild stories. But this one, it's about getting a teeth pulled and then needing a bone graft. And the dentist told him that it was a cadaver bone. And he asked, okay, is it one person or is it a mix of all these people in my mouth? And the dentist was like, I can't disclose that information. And so, well, and then he goes on to say that he thinks that the bone in his mouth is from a woman named Tammy, which, although there is a long history of people thinking that they take on the personalities and traits of the people whose body parts they get transplanted into them, but that's another episode. Anyway.
Oh, no, this episode, which I have thoughts.
Okay, so why did you, what is your pivot here between dentistry, horror, the dental phantom?
I have multiple pivots. The first one is that this idea of like other people literally living on in your body, being subsumed into body, you know, which is what he's talking about. I mean, that is a literal, I think that's as close as a literal phantom, meaning ghost, as we can get. Also that I was reading the comments and a bunch of dentists were like, we don't use human bones. It's probably an animal bone. So this idea of like incorporating an animal into the self, you know, a non-human animal.
And you were just talking about alien and animality. Yes. And the mouth as this form of exactly that. Oh, I see where you're going here. I see.
Yes. And then Deleuze's whole thing about like escaping the face, which I do want to talk about, is part of this process of becoming animal, which I can explain shortly. But the thing that links it all for me is my research for this episode took me to a very unexpected place, but one that you are very familiar with, which is Jenny Edkin's face politics and ideas about face transplants. And I know we want to do a whole separate episode on that, but just to gesture towards it here, in what I think it's the last chapter of her book, it's called Facelessness. And she opens with this quote from Deleuze and Guattari, where she says, when the face is effaced, becomings animal occur. And the chapter is her thinking through what the face does in our society and whether we can find a politics that moves beyond this sort of obsession with the face or like over-identification with the face. And the reason I think all these things are linked has also to do with why I think these objects are so horrifying. And I think, you know, when I first looked at the image, I said, it's funny that the deflective surface reminds me both of a helmet or a mask that you put on and of the skull, you know, or even the meat that is beneath the face. And what Edkins's chapter is all about is people who have facial difference, or, you know, she's talking specifically in this about quote unquote disfigurement, and all of Christie's top hit subjects for her research get mentioned in this chapter. But she talks about how one of the things that listening to and looking at people with facial difference, especially major differences that come from very traumatic events, you know, has to teach us is that in many ways, the face is a mask. And this is something that Deleuze and Guattari think as well, that, and actually Slavoj Žižek as well, we think that we can read the face. we think of the face as the window to the soul. I think eyes are a really important part of this, which is one reason why the eyelessness of these objects is quite interesting. But what happens when people have facial difference is that they become this stared at.
No, but that's exactly, Rosemary Garland Thompson writes about this idea of Baroque staring. Like when someone has a facial difference, it becomes, I'm paraphrasing, but she's like, the looking is not one that is trying to help to understand or even to see or diagnose. It is a Baroque staring that is, I think she says, like with head smacking bewilderment, yeah. What is that? Rather than trying to read the face, it becomes something quite impossible and becomes Baroque, like this grotesque, overdone staring.
Absolutely. And one of the places Edkins takes this is she looks at artistic interventions, portrait painters who paint portraits of people with facial difference. And one of the ones she mentioned was Mark Gilbert.
I literally just met him last month.
That's so exciting. I literally just heard about him this week. Anyway, she covers a lot of ground in this chapter, and I'm not going to be able to get into all of it. But one of the reasons, she talks about a bunch of reasons why people with facial difference get stared at. And one of the things she brings up is that, especially with the sort of intense facial trauma that we saw in the aftermath of World War I and World War II, there's this sense that the inside of the body is visible on the outside. And I think that on the one hand, that relates, you know, a bit to these dental phantoms that we were talking about. But also the sense that what that reveals to us, the fear underlying that, is our realization that the face is the mask, you know, that what we all actually are. And she cites, do you remember the artist, who's the artist who films herself having a...
Orlon.
Yes, exactly. Where she films herself, I don't know exactly what facial surgery is happening, but her skin is getting peeled off her face. And what is being revealed, the moment of shock in that is your sudden realization that what we all actually are, the face is only skin deep. You know, we are all actually the red, bloodied meat that lies under it, which is more like a mask, which we think of as a mask, but is in fact our true self. We are animal. And what Deleuze and Guattari want us to do politically is to move beyond treating the face as the site of like identity politics, as the site of this very Western idea of like, this subject is embodied by the face. Because that is also, I mean, I didn't mention race and class when you said, what do teeth make me think of? But they are such raced and classed objects. But that for Deleuze and Guattari, these lines of flight away from the face, we should undo the face and reveal the animal, the meat, the head, the body beneath.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of this gets revealed, and you mentioned face transplants, a lot of this gets revealed in social attitudes towards face transplants. I mean, it is such an emotionally and socially coded surgery. And the reason that it still hasn't happened in the UK is a lot of the squeamishness around what happens emotionally, what happens physically. I mean, it's also a very physically demanding surgery, and a lot of people don't live that long afterwards. But like, going back to the mouth, the first facial transplant in the early 2000s, Isabel Dinoir in France, she would talk about how the weirdest thing is that she could feel the inside of someone else's mouth after her face transplant. And that is just like, that is what it's all distilled into. It's like the face is the mouth. It's a mask, but it's also your insides. And when it's not your own, that's when it's really unsettling. And when it's terrifying is when someone else is inside your mouth, which is also why I think dentists are so, so scary to so many people.
Let's talk about that, because actually I was thinking of her as well, and partly because this essay says that the link that I didn't quite articulate is, you know, Edkins says the specter of the donor haunts the newly refaced, and also that this transplant patient talks about taking in the subjectivity of the person whose face she got as her own, which is part of this idea of unsettling, the idea of that we are these monadic subjects that are bounded off, that are separated from everyone else. But it is also sort of normatively, that is horrifying. This idea that the self is undone, and moreover at the face, at the mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a really good link. And I think I just want to say my favorite piece to read about facial transplants and this kind of fraught subjectivity and physicality of the operations is Sharona Pearl's work called Face On. It's really, really beautifully written and well done. So I definitely wanted to talk about dental horror, and I'm so glad that we got there through the face. Like, I will talk about the face till the cows come home. So I'm so glad that came home. I'm so glad that that came up.
You're so glad that that particular cow came home.
Just the one cow. But I've been thinking about dental horror recently, even like way before this episode, because I taught a class to my undergrads last year. Well, one of the classes within the wider course, we did a week on medical horror, and dental horror came up because I showed them Little Shop of Horrors, which I know we'll talk about.
Yes.
But I showed them the scene from Little Shop of Horrors where Steve Martin is a sadist dentist. Oh, and we not only looked at that, but we looked at a scene from The Cure for Wellness, which is a horror film from 2016 directed by Gore Verbinski. And we don't have to go into it, but there are two scenes that are very focused on dentistry and on the mouth in particular. One includes a dentist and one is just, it basically is dental cheek retractors and then leeches get shoved down this person's throat. It's horrifying. Ooh. But in that movie that I talked about with my undergrads, the mouth and dentistry is used as a really easy way of getting scares, right? Because I asked them, first of all, like, do you think that the dentist or the doctor is scarier? And almost all of them said
the dentist. Yeah.
But I asked them, I was like, why? Why can you articulate that to me? And they're like, it's because you can go to the doctor and not have to open any orifices.
Yes.
You can go to the doctor and keep yourself intact, but you cannot go to the dentist and keep your personhood, your identity all together. I mean, they didn't say it like that. They were just like, he has to go inside, basically, which again, sexual. But like, I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah. And this is bringing up a lot for me. First of all, the only doctors, I think, beyond dentists that we think are really scary are surgeons. And it's the same thing, right? That they are also going inside. But also thinking about these dental phantoms where what is masked is the eyes and what is exposed is sort of the chimpanzee animal grin. In doctors, what is masked is the mouth. And it makes us realize how much emotion we also read from the mouth. But it's an interesting inverse, you know, that there's this, and I think that there is something about this sterile, medical, machinic, non-human, clinical thing that is so removed from our daily lives and relationships and the messiness of human existence that is in itself quite scary.
Absolutely. And it's the fact that, you know, that non-human, that idea then gets transferred over to the dentist. Like in Little Shop of Horrors,
yes,
he's a sadist without any ability to like understand that other humans feel pain, or he understands that other humans feel pain, but he revels in it. Like, you know, Steve Martin comes in singing about how he used to hit cats over the head, poison guppies.
He says, I get off on the pain I inflict. I think that's super important.
Absolutely. And so it's this idea that like, okay, in order to devote your life to this as a dentist, which is not true. Like, we are not shitting on dentists here, right? That is not the purpose of this. We're talking about like the cultural tropes around why the sphere exists. And so the idea is like, oh, if you're committing your life to this profession of opening up someone's mouth every day of your life and often drilling, removing, inserting, like knocking someone out with anesthesia, what is that about you? And why does that make you scary? Is it like Steve Martin's character, you get off on the pain you inflict or get off on opening this orifice? Like, that's kind of the idea.
And I will say, I have a few thoughts. Firstly, the one thing, yes, no hates to dentists, but the one dentist trope that this movie gets wrong is it makes Steve Martin kind of cool, which like, no offense to dentists, but you know, it's not the image we associate with them the most.
But it's like cool in an abusive boyfriend kind of way, which is
they're supposed to be merging to
read that.
He's an interesting figure because he's half like Elvis. Like he has this like motorbike and his hair, and he's very camp.
And he does the hips.
He does the hips
like Elvis. Like it's very clear. Yeah.
Yeah. But I also think that there's more sort of classic Freudian stuff in this as well. There's a shrine to his mother that is part of the song. And it's all
in his dentist's office.
Exactly. And he beats his wife. He's like very abusive. And it is very much this thing that he gets off on the pain he inflicts. And then the implication is that this perversity comes from this sort of Oedipal complex he has. And it is so, the whole thing is so sexualized. He's wearing a fetish outfit. He's wearing latex. He wears like a black latex outfit. And then
do you it's latex and leather.
And then do you remember the scene where this other fetishist comes in who enjoys the pain that gets inflicted on him by the dentists?
It's Bill Murray. It's Bill Murray.
It's Bill Murray. And he doesn't enjoy, if someone enjoys it, it takes the joy out of it for this sadist. But that whole scene is so sexual. Bill Murray's like moaning as Steve Martin's fingers are in his mouth. Little Shop of Horrors is all about sexual and erotic mouths. The first thing, watching it with this in mind, the first thing that the plant, the horrifying plant does is it puckers its lips. And the first thing it does that makes the main character, whose name Seymour, realize that it's in some way sentient is it's leering at a woman's ass. She bends over this table and it's like got the like sort of cartoon like reaction to like wanting. And then there's like points at which it pulls up the dress of Aubrey and like tries to sexually humiliate Seymour. It like grabs him by the balls, like pulls his pants down. It's all there.
And, you know, the fact that like Steve Martin's character is also seen as this guy with sexual prowess, even though he's a sadist, like those things aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, obviously.
But then also it's just for a flash second. But regarding all of what we've been saying about animality and the dentist, there's a moment where the Steve Martin dentist character shows Seymour, he's like, if you don't brush your teeth, you'll look like this. And he flashes an image onto the screen very fast, and it's a dog's mouth.
That's so interesting.
Which I think is so interesting to think about with these, like the dental phantoms and being treated like a piece of meat, being treated like an animal and doing big scare quotes around everything I'm saying. But I think they all draw this together.
But where do you find, so being treated as non-human, being treated as animal, but where do you find the line between the dental phantom as something that might be non-human in the animal sense and the dental phantom as something that might be non-human in the machine sense? Where do you find that line?
I mean, I think that sort of cyborg feminism, or even not to go there, queer ecologies, a lot of different fields at the moment today would tell us that those are not necessarily distinct characters. That firstly, to be human is to incorporate the non-human, whether quote-unquote living or quote-unquote dead in many different ways. I mean, one of the first dental interventions will have been dental jewelry, whether that's drilling into teeth to insert gems or other mineral objects or adding gold.
From thousands of years ago, like the Mayans put so many jewels in their teeth,
So incorporating literal metals into our body, infusing them with our bodies, not least to think about all that sort of titanium plates that many people now live within their bodies, or permanent, what's the wire behind your teeth that you get after you have braces? Tools have always been our, I don't want to say prostheses, but, you know, have been a part of us, have been a part of the human animal, and not a bounded subject, and not, the faces, we are not different. It doesn't keep us from our animality and from our, connected interconnectedness.
So I think that's really interesting. And I also think it's really important to note how throughout history, those of lower socioeconomic statuses, of lower classes are the ones who are treated as the machines, the animals, the spare parts.
Yeah.
I mean, like if you look in dentistry in particular, like if you look at, I mean, there are so many satirical prints from the 18th and early 19th century in Britain that focus on teeth. If you look at Thomas Rowlandson's print, Transplanting of Teeth, you've got all of these wealthy people who are getting new teeth put into their mouths by this dentist. And in the middle, you have this completely gray or almost black figure. And at first, it takes you a second to realize what's going on. And you think, oh, is that race? Which we can talk about that interpretation of this image as well. But he's supposed to be a chimney sweep. He's covered in soot, right? And his teeth are being taken out to be implanted into the mouths of wealthy people. So this idea of like human machine in dentist is very class coded. And then of course, like the wealthy people become cyborgs in a way, not cyborgs maybe, but like made up of different components, right? Like that TikTok that you showed at the hands of the dentist, which is so interesting, that long history.
Well, I mean, I think maybe class and race is an interesting way to close out this episode, because those are aspects that are so associated with teeth. I mean, for one thing, in the UK, you know, dentistry is not covered by the NHS. So having nice teeth becomes, as it always has been, a status of class. And if you think about, you know, turkey teeth, as they call them in the UK, you know, people who, the stereotype is like, you know, before you go on Love Island, you are sort of working class, young lad from Essex or the Midlands or the North, you know, these places that are coded as like not upper class, go off to Turkey to get your cheap, pearly white, perfect tombstone dentures. Or also, I mean, you know, the longstanding, I don't know if it's a rumor or if it's true, but it's extremely believable. And it, you know, it gestures towards similar practices that were happening at the time anyway, that George Washington had a whole set of dentures from enslaved people.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I remember seeing this meme or tweet that was floating around that was like, okay, so according to my insurance, my teeth are luxury bones. Like I have to pay to keep these, I have to pay to keep these bones in my head. Like, because that's the way that it's framed within a lot of medical systems.
Which is wild because like, I feel like the record seems to show that they're the thing that goes the most wrong the most often and needs to get removed the most.
And they cause so many issues. Like if you have bad teeth, it causes so many other problems in your life and in your body.
Well, it's just like, you know, shocker, like the healthcare industrial complex doesn't want to pay, what doesn't want to cover a relatively small thing like dental care that would reduce the cost massively elsewhere in the system because of all the other gut health, whatever issues that come from, you know, poor teeth care and like teeth issues.
Absolutely. And I think like this long history of also the moralization of teeth care, like the impetus on the individual. Yeah. I'm going to tie this back to race and class because like teeth had a big role in like physiognomy. Lavater wrote about how bad teeth showed that you were of bad character when of course it was mostly class coded. And so like the slippages of these things are like the specter of dentistry, right? That really have such an impact on the way that people are treated because again, they are both internal and external and it just feels so personal. And that's perhaps why the phantom is so terrifying because it's like, oh, that's so exposed.
I have to say, this is one of those episodes that reminds me of why I enjoy doing this podcast so much. Because you sent me this object and I was like, Chrissy, I have nothing to say about this. I have nothing to say about dentists. I have nothing to say about these creepy ass objects. I have nothing to say about the history of medicine and of models. And yeah, I'm really grateful to you for introducing me to these creepy things that are going to haunt my nightmares now, as well as the teeth falling out dreams. And
I love
just open onto all these lines of flight.